Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a subject that is absolutely foundational for anyone working in California agriculture.
Yeah.
Understanding the pests you might encounter, and crucially, the very specific rules around handling the tools you use to manage them.
It's an area packed with critical information, you know, and getting it right impacts everything from safety to compliance to how effective your efforts actually are on the farm.
You've handed us a stack of sources for this deep dive, leaning heavily on material like identifying and understanding agricultural pests. Think of this as our roadmap through this essential knowledge.
And that material, as you'll see, it's really designed to give you the core knowledge needed for safe, effective, and, well, legal pest management here in California.
Right. So our mission today is basically to cut through the noise and pull out the most important insights from these sources. Things like what regulations you absolutely must know, the different types of pests lurking out there, why being a good pest detective is, frankly, non-negotiable, and how to avoid mistaking a problem for something it isn't, which sounds tricky.
It can be. Consider this your focused briefing on the essentials. You know, whether you're directly handling pesticides yourself, supervising a crew, or maybe just aiming to understand this vital part of farming operations in the state.
Okay, let's stop talking about the sources and dive right into them. We're starting with the regulatory side because, well, as the material makes clear, that's the first thing you really need to nail down.
Yeah, if you're handling pesticides on a California farm, there's just no way around this.
Yeah.
You are required by federal, state, and local law to know and follow the regulations, period.
And the sources really drive home that these rules aren't static, are they? They emphasize how important it is to constantly review updated resources.
Right.
They specifically mention the Pesticide Safety Information Series leaflets, PSIS leaflets. You can grab them at your county ag commissioner's office or find them online, DPR website, cdpr.ca.gov.
Exactly. Staying updated isn't, like, optional. It's part of the job. And a key legal requirement highlighted is this. If you use California restricted materials, you must be a certified applicator.
Okay, restricted materials require certification. So even if a farm brings in, say, a commercial company to spray those specific restricted materials, someone on the farm operation itself, owner, manager, leaseholder, maybe a key employee, they need to hold a private applicator certification. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. That private applicator certification, the PIAC, is basically your ticket to legally purchase, possess, and use restricted materials on your own farm operation.
Gotcha.
And the sources are also very clear on defining who exactly is considered a pesticide handler.
Okay, let's unpack that definition. Who fits that description according to this material? Because it sounds like it might be broader than just the person holding the spray gun.
It absolutely is broader. Yeah, the source clarifies that a handler is anyone who handles opened pesticide containers. Anyone who mixes, loads, or applies pesticides.
Yeah.
But it also includes people assisting in application activities, like flagging fields.
Okay, so beyond the sprayer and their direct assistant, who else?
Well, it extends to incorporating pesticides into the soil, adjusting or removing coverings after treatment, like tarps, or even entering treated areas before the required safety interval, the REI, has passed. And this is a key point. Handling equipment that might have pesticide residues on it, that can make you a handler, too.
Wow. Okay, that definition covers a lot more roles on a farm than I might have initially guessed. So knowing all this requires special skills, understanding the hazards, knowing the laws about storage, transport, application, disposal.
Yeah.
The whole nine yards.
Precisely. And if you're in a supervisory role, the responsibility to ensure your handlers are working properly and safely, well, ultimately that falls on your shoulders.
So with all that responsibility, how does someone go about getting this essential private applicator certification, the PASC?
The path is pretty clear. You have to prove you have the competence and the knowledge for safe handling and supervision, especially when it comes to those restricted use chemicals.
And how do you prove that?
You do that by passing the California Private Applicator Certification Examination. The PACACI exam.
Right, okay. And passing the exam gets you certified, but you still need that permit from your county ag commissioner's office to actually acquire and use restricted materials on your farm.
Correct. Correct. Certification proves competence. The permit grants permission for purchase and use. And that certification isn't for life either.
Right, I thought so.
The PAC is valid for a set period, usually 3 years. To maintain it, you need to either complete 6 hours of approved continuing education credits within those 3 years.
Okay.
Or simply retake and pass the exam again.
And a really crucial distinction the source makes is that this PPAC is specifically for agricultural applications.
Yes, very important point.
If you need to apply pesticides in other contexts, like, say, post-harvest situations or non-agricultural settings landscape, structural that requires different certifications from the DPR.
That's a really important boundary to understand. The material we're diving into today, this study guide, it's explicitly designed to provide the core knowledge needed specifically for that PAC exam. Its whole purpose is preparing you to demonstrate competence in safe and effective use, preventing accidents, and avoiding problems for people and the environment.
Which brings us neatly to thinking about how to approach studying this kind of material effectively, especially if you're aiming for that certification yourself.
Yeah, and the source guide itself actually gives you a sort of blueprint for how to use it effectively.
Mm-hmm.
It explains that the whole structure is built to help you prepare for the PAC exam.
And they include these things called knowledge expectations at the start of chapters and alongside the text. These are basically hints telling you what you should really focus on, what's likely going to be assessed on the exam.
Right. They're like signposts. And this is an important caution they give. Not everything you need to know is specifically marked this way. So you still need to read through everything thoroughly to get the full picture and the context. You can't just study the marked bits.
And the DPR exams themselves are designed to test your understanding of handling or supervising the use of restricted-use pesticides, specifically under California law. They even suggest that the questions you'll encounter on the exam will be pretty similar to the review questions included right there in the guide.
That's a great tip for studying. And the guide even provides a recommended strategy. Start by reading those knowledge expectations and the review questions first.
Before reading the chapter.
Before diving deep into the chapter text. Yeah. That helps you immediately identify what you maybe don't already understand or feel confident about. Then go back and study the specific sections in the chapter that cover those weaker areas.
Okay, that makes sense. Target your studying.
Exactly. And then finally, answer the questions, check your answers against the ones provided, and really focus on restudying anything you missed. They also note the appendices have extra info, but it's generally not on the exam.
That's a really practical approach to tackling what can be dense material.
Yeah.
Okay, shifting gears now from the regulatory how to the practical what understanding the pests themselves. And here's where it gets, well, really unnerving.
This is where the detective work begins. Absolutely. Okay. The sources are incredibly clear on this. Before you do anything to control a pest, you absolutely must identify exactly what it is and understand its basic biology.
And this is critical, you mentioned. You need to be certain that the damage you're looking at is actually caused by the pest you suspect.
Yes.
And not something else entirely. That sounds like a common pitfall.
It really is. Yeah. Once you have that positive identification, then you dig into the pest's life cycle, how it grows, and critically, how that matches up with the life cycle and growth of the plant or animal it's affecting, the host. That combined knowledge is the only way to plan effective control strategies, knowing when it's vulnerable, when the host is vulnerable.
The source highlights this with a really important insight, misidentification, not having enough information about the pest, or misunderstanding the vulnerable stages of the host, plant, or animal. These are listed as the most common reasons why pest control efforts fail.
It's fundamental. You might pick the completely wrong method or apply a good method at totally the wrong time, and you've just wasted time, money, potentially harmed beneficials, or caused other issues.
It all starts with knowing your enemy, so to speak.
Exactly. And the sources introduce the four main groups of common pests you'll likely encounter in California agriculture. First, weeds, basically, any plant growing where you don't want it.
Okay.
Second, invertebrates, which is a huge category covering everything without a backbone. Think insects, mites, nematodes, snails, slugs.
Right, the creepy crawlies.
Many of them, yeah. Third, vertebrates animals with backbones, like birds, rodents, other mammals that become pests. And fourth, pathogens, which are the microscopic organisms like fungi, bacteria, and viruses that cause diseases in plants or animals.
Okay, four big groups. So we need to be detectives. What tools does the source suggest for actually doing that identification work out in the field or, you know, back at the office?
A great starting point is simply using visual aids, good pictures, and detailed descriptions like those found in the source material itself. Beyond that, key resources are identification guides. The source really points to those from UC Cooperative Extension, their print publications, and especially their online materials, like the UC IPM website, ipm.uknr.edu. That's an essential reference.
Or if you're really stumped, you can send samples off to a specialist who can examine and identify the pest for you, right?
Absolutely. And a pro tip from the source, when you're collecting samples for identification, always try to collect several specimens if you can.
Not just one bug.
Ideally not. Get examples of different life stages if possible, like larvae and adults, or showing various symptoms of the damage you're seeing. It gives the expert more to work with.
What's fascinating here is that many pests, particularly things like mites, nematodes, and pathogens, are incredibly small, sometimes microscopic. Getting a definitive ID often requires more than just looking with your eyes, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. You might need a good hand lens, maybe even a microscope back at the office or lab. Sometimes special chemical tests are needed, or just very careful, detailed analysis of the pattern of damage.
And this ties into another key point. You mentioned distinguishing pest damage from things caused by abiotic factors.
Exactly. Non-living environmental issues. We'll get more into that. But you often need diagnostic tools or careful observation to tell those apart because they can look really similar.
And connecting this to the bigger picture, the source reminds us that context is everything in identification.
Totally. What type of host plant or animal is it? Where exactly on the farm did you find it? What are the environmental conditions like right now? Hot, cold, wet, dry? Even the time of year provides important clues. The UC IPM website is great for linking specific host plants with the pest most likely to affect them at certain times of year.
And remember that pests change their appearance throughout their lives. A weed seedling looks nothing like a mature plant.
Right, or insects going through different stages, egg, larva, pupa. You might only find one stage. And correct identification is also critical because sometimes beneficial organisms, the good guys, or even protected endangered species, might look like pests at certain life stages. You definitely don't want to accidentally harm those.
So for the really tough identifications like nematodes or most plant pathogens, you really need trained experts.
Yes, the source confirms that. Things that require specialized lab methods or equipment, they list resources. You go to private diagnostic labs, pest control companies, veterinarians for animal issues, or licensed pest control advisors. Sometimes there's a fee involved.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also often free or low-cost options available through your local UC Cooperative Extension advisors, your county agricultural commissioner's office, or the state's Plant Pest Diagnostic Center at the CDFA. Lots of places to turn for help.
The source also talks about using identification keys. How do those actually work? They sound a bit technical.
They can seem that way, but they're basically structured tools designed to walk you through the identification process step by step. The sources mentioned dichotomous keys.
Dichotomous.
Yeah, it means divided into two parts. These keys work by giving you a series of paired statements, usually based on visible characteristics like size, color, shape of a body part. You look closely at your specimen. Choose the statement from the pair that best matches what you see.
Okay.
And that choice directs you to the next pair of statements. You keep making these choices, following the path, and each step narrows down the possibilities until, hopefully, you arrive at the correct identification.
Ah, okay, like a choose your own adventure, but for bugs and weeds. The example they give for identifying grasses is great looking at tiny details, like whether the new leaf is rolled or folded inside the sheath, or checking for tiny structures near the base of the leaf blade called auricles and ligules.
Exactly. Those specific physical characteristics are the clues the key uses.
Yeah.
They also really emphasize the value of good photographs and drawings, like those in the source material or in referenced guides like the UC IPM manuals or the CDFA Vertebrate Handbook. Seeing what the pest looks like, and just as importantly, what its typical damage looks like, provides absolutely vital visual confirmation.
And speaking of damage, pests often leave characteristic signs behind beyond just the chewed leaves or whatever.
They absolutely do. And these signs are crucial detective clues. Think about unique nests that certain birds or rodents build. Rodents leave behind telltale trails, tracks, specific shapes of fecal pellets, maybe insect parts called frass, distinctive burrow entrances, or specific gnaw marks on wood or irrigation lines.
Yep.
Insects leave very particular feeding patterns or holes. Weeds might have unique flowers or seeds, a particular way of growing, or even the dried remains of last season's plants can help with ID. Fungi and pathogens often cause specific types of deformation, discoloration, or growths. Finding these signs can be just as important as finding the pest itself.
All right, armed with these identification tools and strategies, let's dig into those four main groups of pests we mentioned earlier, starting with the first one, weeds.
Right, the unwanted plants.
Yeah.
And they cause problems in, well, a whole bunch of ways.
They compete directly with your crops, right? For the basics, water, nutrients, sunlight, even just physical space.
Exactly. They can also interfere with farming operations like cultivation or harvesting. Some are actually poisonous to livestock if eaten. A few release chemicals that inhibit crop growth. That's called allelopathy. They can clog up irrigation ditches or emitters, contaminate the harvested product, think weed seeds and grain, and they often provide shelter or alternative food sources for insect pests or plant diseases.
Okay, so lots of reasons to manage them. The sources break down most common weeds into two big categories, right? Broadleaves and grasses.
That's the main division. Broadleaves, also called dicots, usually sprout with two seed leaves, have broader leaves with net-like veins. Think dandelions, pigweed, field bindweed. They can be herbaceous or woody. The other main group is grasses, which are monocots. They start with just one seed leaf, have narrow leaves with parallel veins. This group also technically includes sedges and rushes, which look grass-like but have key differences.
And less common things like mosses and algae can sometimes be weeds too.
Right, especially algae in water systems or greenhouses.
And understanding their life cycle is really key to controlling them effectively.
Absolutely fundamental. The sources describe annuals. These live for 1 year or less, reproducing only by seed. They break them down further into summer annuals, which sprout in spring, grow, flower, set seed, and die by fall, things like little mallow or barnyard grass. And winter annuals, which sprout in the fall, grow through the winter, produce seed in the spring, and die before summer hits. Wild oat or Italian ryegrass are common examples. Though if conditions are right, some annuals can pop up almost year-round in California.
Then there are biennials, living for two seasons.
Correct. They typically focus on vegetative growth, like forming a rosette of leaves in the first year. Then in the second year, they both send up a flower stalk, produce seed, and then die. Poison hemlock and common mullein are classic examples.
And finally, the really tough ones, perennials.
Yeah, these live for two or more years, and some can live pretty much indefinitely. They can regrow year after year from their roots or from specialized underground structures like tubers, think nut's edge, bulbs, or rhizomes like Johnson grass or Bermuda grass. And those underground parts are often how they spread vegetatively too. Woody plants like trees and shrubs are also perennials.
And the source specifically notes these are often the hardest weeds to control.
Definitely, because you have to deal with those persistent root systems or underground organs, not just the top growth or seeds. Field bindweed, yellow nutsedge, Johnson grass, Bermuda grass, notorious perennial problems.
The source also gives specific examples within these types, like algae causing problems by clogging water systems or depleting oxygen.
Right, and sedges and rushes, which are often confused with grasses but are distinct. Sedges usually have triangular stems. Sedges have edges, is the mnemonic, while rushes often have round, solid stems. Both love wet areas, common in marshy fields, rice paddies, ditches. Yellow nutsedge and river bulrush are examples.
And grasses themselves, identifiable by that collar region where the leaf blade meets the sheath, found everywhere. Annuals like wild oat or perennials like Bermuda grass.
Mm-hmm. And broadleaves, also found just about everywhere, incredibly diverse in leaf shape and growth habit. Annuals like puncture vine or reed root pigweed, perennials like field bindweed or yellow star thistle.
Okay, that covers weeds. Moving on to the second major group, invertebrates. This is a big one, all the animals without a backbone.
And it is a huge and incredibly diverse group. You've got nematodes, tiny roundworms, other worms, snails, slugs, and then all the arthropods. That includes insects, ticks, mites, spiders, centipedes, millipedes.
Wow.
They impact humans and agriculture in so many ways. Some are parasites of animals. Many transmit diseases to both plants and animals. Hordes of them feed directly on our crops, herbivores, or consume and contaminate stored food products. And some can even damage structures or equipment.
The source provides a nice summary table of the kinds of damage invertebrates cause, right? Chewing holes in leaves, boring into stems or fruit, sucking plant juices.
Yeah, feeding on roots, causing those weird growths called galls, transmitting plant pathogens. And if they're pests of animals, the damage includes bites or stings, feeding on flesh or blood, transmitting serious animal diseases, reducing the productivity or value of livestock, or damaging hides and carcasses. A huge range of impacts.
Let's maybe zoom in on a few specific examples the source mentions to get a feel for this group. Ticks and mites, for instance.
Okay. Key feature to look for. Adult ticks and mites usually have four pairs of legs, unlike insects, which have three. Immature stages might have fewer. Mites are often tiny, some spin protective webbing. They can cause severe economic losses in plants through discoloration, distortion, defoliation, and some transmit pathogens. Ticks are generally larger, exclusively blood feeders on vertebrates. Their bites can itch, so inject toxins causing paralysis, and they're infamous vectors of diseases like Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
But the source note's a really important flip side for mites, doesn't it?
It does. Critically important, some mites are beneficial predators, feeding on pest mites or small insects. They're crucial players in biological control programs. So again, correct ID is vital before you spray.
Good point. Chewing lice and sucking lice are also discussed, mainly pests of animals.
Yes. Both are small, wingless insects, usually host-specific, often needing magnification to see clearly. Chewing lice have, well, chewing mouthparts and feed on skin debris, feathers, hair. They cause restlessness and reduce production in poultry and damage wool in sheep. Sucking lice have piercing, sucking mouthparts to feed on blood, primarily on mammals like cattle and goats. They cause irritation, itching, anemia, reduced milk production, hair loss, and can transmit some animal pathogens.
Thrips, I know those can be pests in gardens and greenhouses. Tiny little thing.
Very tiny, yeah. Usually slender, elongated bodies, often with two pairs of distinctive fringed wings, though some are wingless. They have unique, sucking, rasping mouthparts. They damage plants by puncturing cells and sucking out the contents, which causes silvery patches, distorted growth on fruit and leaves, sometimes leaves behind tiny black fecal spots visible under a hand lens. They're serious pests in many crops, strawberries, citrus, onions, flowers.
Any beneficials there?
Yes. Again, a few species of thrips are actually beneficial predators of pest insects and mites, important in biocontrol, especially in greenhouses sometimes.
True bugs. This includes things like stink bugs, leaf-footed bugs, legus bugs, and the notorious bagrata bug we hear about on coal crops.
That's the group. A key identification feature for many true bugs is a distinct triangular plate, the scutellum, on their thorax between the wing bases. They also have piercing, sucking mouthparts, like a beak, that folds under the body when not feeding. Their forewings are often thickened at the base and membranous at the tip, called hemelytra. They damage plants by feeding, which can cause spots, deformities, or kill tissue. Some inject chemicals that alter plant growth. They're significant agricultural pests on many crops.
But same pattern here.
Same pattern. Some true bug species are important beneficial predators, like assassin bugs, big-eyed bugs, and minute pirate bugs, which feed on other insects, including many pests.
Okay. Aphids, whiteflies, mealybugs, and scales are all kind of grouped together in the source. Soft-bodied sucking pests.
Exactly. A very diverse group in appearance, but generally soft-bodied, many with complex life cycles, including winged forms for dispersal. They all have piercing, sucking mouthparts and feed on plant sap. The damage is often similar. Sucking liquids causes yellowing, distorted leaves and fruits, reduced plant vigor, stunting, branch dieback, a classic sign associated with many of them.
Honeydew.
That sticky, sugary excretion, it drips onto leaves and fruit, and then black sooty mold fungus grows on it, which is ugly and can interfere with photosynthesis. Plus, many, many species in this group are efficient vectors of plant viruses. Huge pests on fruits, nuts, vegetables, ornamentals.
Then we have another group of sap feeders, leaf hoppers, cicadas, psyllids, phylloxerans, sharpshooters, tree hoppers. Quite a list.
Yeah, almost all of these also have piercing, sucking mouthparts and feed on plant sap. A few plant hoppers feed on fungi or mosses. Many have short antenna. Adults are often winged and quite mobile. A key impact for many in this group, besides direct feeding damage, is their role as vectors of plant diseases, particularly viruses, but also some bacteria and phytoplasmas.
Like sharpshooters and Pierce's disease in grapes.
That's the classic example, yes. They can also cause physical damage, like scarring on fruits, or cause leaves to discolor or blacken, hop, or burn. And yes, some produce honeydew, leading to sooty mold. Very damaging in grapes, citrus, fruit trees, vegetable crops, and nurseries.
Butterflies, moths, and skippers. Here, the adults are often noticeable, sometimes beautiful, but it's the larvae, the caterpillars, that are usually the problem pests, right?
Exactly right. The adults typically have scale-covered wings, often colorful and coiled, sucking tube mouthparts for feeding on nectar. But the larvae are the worm-like caterpillars with powerful chewing mouthparts. They go through complete metamorphosis, egg, larva, pupa, often in a cocoon or chrysalis, then adult. And as the source points out, moth larvae are some of the most significant agricultural pests worldwide. Think army worms, cutworms, coddling moth, tomato fruit worm. They cause serious damage chewing on fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, cotton, forage crops, you name it.
Okay. Flies, mosquitoes, gnats, midges, another huge group, including pests we hear about often now, like spotted winged Drosophila or things like leaf miners.
Yes. The defining characteristic of this order, Diptera, is that the adults have only one pair of functional wings. The second pair is reduced to small, club-like balancing organs called halters. Mouthparts vary greatly, sucking, lapping, piercing, biting. Their larvae are typically legless maggots.
And the impact?
Immense and varied. Many are serious pests. Some larvae invade living animal tissues, miasis, or plant tissues, like leaf miners or fruit maggots. Adults like mosquitoes, biting flies, some gnats and midges feed on blood, causing irritation and transmitting serious diseases to humans and animals, malaria, West Nile virus, etc. They are major pests in crops. Think fruit flies like spotted-winged Drosophila devastating berries, or leaf miners in vegetables, or fungus gnats in greenhouses, and also in livestock and poultry operations. Horn flies, stable flies.
Any good flies?
Surprisingly, yes. A number of fly species are beneficial. Some are parasitic on pest insects, like tachinid flies. Others are predators, like hoverfly larvae eating aphids. Important components of biocontrol.
And finally, rounding out the invertebrates in the source. Snails and slugs. Not insects, but definitely pests.
Right, they're mollusks. They thrive in cool, damp conditions. Snails have that characteristic shell, which provides protection and allows them to seal themselves off and survive dry periods, sometimes for years. Slugs lack a shell, making them more vulnerable to heat and dehydration, so they stick to moist environments.
And the damage they cause?
They feed primarily with a rasping mouthpart called a radula, scraping away at plant tissue. They damage foliage, fruits, berries, seedlings, and vegetables. They could be serious pests in citrus groves, feeding on developing fruit and leaves, and also in greenhouses and gardens. And the telltale sign they leave behind.
Those lovely slime trails.
Exactly. Which, besides being unsightly, can reduce the marketability of produce or ornamental plants. And believe it or not, there are even some predatory snails used in biocontrol to help manage pest snail populations, like the decollete snail.
Okay, that's a really comprehensive look at the sheer variety of invertebrate pests. Let's move on to the third major group identified in the source, vertebrates.
Right, the animals with backbones, fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. They become pests when their activities conflict with human interests.
How so?
They might host or transmit disease pathogens dangerous to humans, or domestic animals, think plague from rodents or rabies from mammals. They can cause direct damage by eating or contaminating crops or stored products. Sometimes their activities, like burrowing, create conditions that favor other pests, like weeds. Some prey on livestock. Or they just interfere with people or structures.
Birds are a classic example mentioned. They can spread poultry pathogens between farms or cause significant economic damage by eating or damaging ripening crops like grapes, cherries, blueberries, or grains.
And this brings up a vital regulatory point the source makes. Even if a particular bird species is causing damage on your own property, many species are protected. You might need a specific depredation permit from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or work under the supervision of your county agricultural commissioner before you can legally trap or remove them.
So you absolutely must check the regulations before taking any action against birds.
Absolutely crucial. Don't assume you could just deal with them.
Mammals are another significant group of vertebrate pests. The source highlights pocket gophers.
Ah, yes. The bane of many farmers and ranchers. These are burrowing rodents, easily identified by their external fur-lined cheek pouches they use for carrying food, not internal like squirrels. Mm. They're highly adapted for digging strong legs, claws, streamlined body, small eyes and ears, sensitive whiskers. They're active year-round, day and night. Mostly solitary creatures, except during breeding.
And they can be numerous.
Very. In irrigated areas like alfalfa fields or orchards, densities can exceed 60 gophers per acre. They primarily damage crops by feeding on roots and sometimes girdling the trunks of vines and trees below ground. Citrus, alfalfa, and many types of fruit and nut trees are vulnerable. A single gopher can kill a young tree surprisingly quickly. Plus, their burrowing can damage buried irrigation lines, and their tunnels can divert irrigation water, leading to waste and soil erosion.
And the other common rodent pest mentioned is California ground squirrels.
Right. Very common pests throughout much of California, especially in orchards, vineyards, and alfalfa fields. They live in colonies, which can grow quite large over time. They're most active during the cooler parts of hot days or during sunny periods in the cooler months, typically morning and late afternoon. They retreat to their burrows during high winds or extreme heat.
And they're damaged.
They damage young vines and trees by gnawing on the bark, sometimes girdling them completely, and also by eating twigs and leaves. And maybe even more significantly, their extensive burrowing around roots and throughout fields is very destructive, weakening trees and creating hazards for equipment and irrigation.
Wow, okay. It's clear the range of potential pests, from weeds to worms to gophers, is incredibly vast. But the source makes another crucial distinction that seems just as important as identifying the pest itself, recognizing problems that aren't actually caused by pests at all.
Yes, this section on diseases versus disorders is absolutely essential. It's all about avoiding misdiagnosis. Because applying a pesticide when the problem isn't a pest or pathogen, well, it's not going to work. It wastes money, and it could potentially harm the environment or even make the underlying problem worse.
Okay, so the source clearly separates diseases from disorders.
Diseases are caused by living organisms, those pathogens we mentioned in the fourth pest group, primarily fungi, bacteria, viruses, and also related things like viroids and phytoplasmas.
Got it. Living culprits. Whereas disorders are caused by...
Disorders are caused by non-living or abiotic factors. These are environmental issues. Things like nutrient deficiencies or excesses in the soil, extreme temperatures, both high and low, toxicity from excessive salts or misapplied pesticides or herbicides, air pollution, problems with water, either too much or too little, soil compaction, changes in soil grade, physical injury.
A whole host of environmental stresses.
Exactly. And both diseases and disorders disrupt a plant's normal functions and can produce symptoms that look strikingly similar, wilting, yellowing spots, dieback. That's why identifying the actual underlying cause is so critical before you decide on any kind of treatment, especially pesticides.
Okay, let's look closer at the pathogens first, starting with fungi.
Right. Most fungi are microscopic, though some produce visible structures like mushrooms or mold growth. Their basic body structure is a network of fine threads called hyphae, and a mass of hyphae is called mycelium. They reproduce and spread primarily through spores, which come in a huge variety of shapes and sizes. Identifying specific fungi often involves looking closely at those spores or the structures that produce them, fruiting bodies, their size, shape, color, arrangement.
And the damage symptoms they cause are really varied, too.
Incredibly varied, yeah. You might see distinct leaf spots, larger dead areas called blight, sunken lesions on stems called cankers, dieback of branches or shoots, rots affecting roots, stems, or fruits, seedlings collapsing right at the soil line, damping off, crusty lesions called scab, overall stunting, and importantly, deformed plant parts, things like enlarged roots, club root, strange growths or warts, excessive branching, sometimes called witch's brooms, curled or distorted leaves, sudden wilting or powdery or rusty-looking buildup on the plant surface, which are characteristic of powdery mildews and rust fungi.
So lots of visual clues, but sometimes confusing.
Very often. While field diagnosis based on symptoms can give you a good idea, getting a sample analyzed in a lab is often recommended for confirmation, because different fungal diseases or even non-fungal problems can sometimes look alike.
And how do they survive and spread?
Their life cycles are diverse, but spores are usually central. They're incredibly good at surviving unfavorable conditions, often as dormant mycelium or tough, resistant resting spores like sclerotia, in or on infected plant debris, in the soil, in buds, bark cankers, or sometimes carried on seeds or vegetated planting material. Some even survive on alternate host plants.
And dispersal, how do they get around?
Lots of ways. Some fungi have specialized root-like structures called rhizomorphs that can grow through the soil. But many, many fungal spores are tiny and light and travel long distances on air currents. Water is also key. Splashing rain or irrigation can spread spores, and many fungi need free water on the plant surface to germinate and infect. They're also spread by insects, animals, human activity, like on contaminated tools or equipment, and through infected seeds, transplants, nursery stock, or contaminated soil potting mix.
But not all fungi are bad, right?
Absolutely not. A crucial point the source makes. Many fungi form beneficial symbiotic relationships with plant roots, mycorrhizae, helping them absorb nutrients. Others are used in biological control, attacking soil-borne diseases, foliar pathogens, or even pest insects, mites, and nematodes. They're really important components of healthy soil and integrated pest management, IPM.
Okay, next pathogen group, bacteria.
These are much simpler and generally much smaller than fungi, single-celled organisms. Positive identification almost always requires lab techniques like culturing or molecular tests. So field diagnosis relies heavily on recognizing characteristic symptoms.
What kind of symptoms?
Common bacterial disease symptoms include cankers, dead sunken areas on stems, branches, galls, those unusual tumor-like growths, sudden wilting of leaves or stems, overall slow growth, soft rots of fruits or storage organs, which are often slimy and might have a foul odor, discoloration of tissues, deformed plant parts, slow ripening of fruit, twiggy growth called brooming, or distinct leaf spots. A potential key sign for some bacterial diseases is a slimy ooze coming out of the affected tissue, which contains masses of bacteria. Examples mentioned include things like olive knot or crown gall causing those galls.
Right, which interfere with the plant's vascular system. Or bacterial wilts that affect the entire plant by producing slime that plugs up the water-conducting tissues, xylem, common in tomatoes, cotton, cucumbers, corn. Bacterial cankers can destroy tissue, like in tomato canker or the devastating fire blight in pears and apples. Bacterial spotting diseases, like potato scab, affect surfaces. And those soft rots often invade fleshy tissues, sometimes as secondary infections after injury.
How do they get in and survive?
Bacteria typically need an entry point natural openings like stomata, leaf pores, or hydatodes, or wounds caused by insects, hail, pruning, etc. Once inside, they move either within the plant's sap stream, vascular system, or between the cells. They mostly survive within living host plants, or sometimes on seeds, or for shorter periods in plant debris or soil. Unlike fungi, they don't produce specialized overwintering spores, but many can survive winter protected within infected plant litter or cankers.
And how do they spread from plant to plant?
Water is a major factor. Splashing rain or irrigation carries bacteria. Anything that moves moist soil, like cultivation equipment. Infected seeds, cuttings, or transplants are common sources. And critically, many bacteria are spread by vectors, insects, or other animals that carry them from diseased to healthy plants. The source gives examples like cucumber beetles transmitting bacterial wilt of cucumbers, or sharpshooter leafhoppers transmitting the bacterium that causes Pierce's disease in grapes.
Okay, third pathogen group, viruses. Even tinier than bacteria.
Much tinier, yes. They're basically just genetic material, RNA or DNA, wrapped in a protein coat. They're so small and transparent that you can't see them even with a standard light microscope. So identification relies almost entirely on the symptoms they cause in the host plant, or sometimes by detecting the virus itself using specialized lab tests, like ELISA or PCR.
And the symptoms, often mosaic patterns.
That's a classic one, yes. Irregular patches of light green, yellow, or white mixed with normal green tissue, forming a mosaic or mottled pattern. Other common symptoms include reduced growth or stunting, other color changes like yellowing or vein clearing, where the veins look lighter than the surrounding tissue, deformities like leaf rolling, crinkling, or strap-like leaves, tissue death, necrosis, appearing as spots or streaks, reduced yields, and sometimes excessive branching, leading to stunting or rosetting.
How do viruses work? How do they survive and spread?
Viruses are obligate parasites. They must have a living host cell to replicate. They aren't really cellular organisms themselves. They hijack the host cell's machinery to make more copies of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
Critically, they generally cannot survive in dead plant matter or for long periods outside a living host or vector. They typically survive between growing seasons in perennial host plants, including weeds or volunteer crop plants, or sometimes within their insect vectors.
And they have to enter through a wound. They can't just infect a healthy surface.
Correct. Viruses only get into plant cells through some kind of wound. This might be a microscopic wound caused by an insect vector feeding, or mechanical damage from tools or handling, or through natural processes like grafting using infected material, or sometimes via infected pollen during pollination. Once inside a cell, they replicate and can move from cell to cell through tiny connections, plasmosmata, and some can move longer distances throughout the plant via the vascular system, phloem.
And dispersal to new plants.
Primarily through vegetative propagation using infected cuttings or rootstock, mechanical transfer of sap on tools or hands, sometimes through infected seeds or pollen, but most commonly and efficiently through vectors. The source lists a whole range of vectors. Aphids, leafhoppers, whiteflies, beetles, thrips, mites, nematodes, even some soil-borne fungi and parasitic plants like dodder can transmit specific viruses. And the relationship is often very specific. A particular virus is transmitted only by a certain type or species of vector. Mealybug spreading grape leaf roll virus or beet leafhopper spreading tomato curly top virus are examples.
Okay, so we've got the four main pest groups: weeds, invertebrates, and the pathogens, fungi, bacteria, viruses that cause diseases. But the source saves a really crucial section for last, abiotic factors causing disorders. This sounds like where the confusion often lies.
This is absolutely the final critical piece of the diagnostic puzzle. And yes, it's vital because this is where misdiagnosis happens frequently. These are problems caused by unfavorable environmental conditions, often conditions we humans have inadvertently created or influenced. And the challenge is their symptoms can look exactly like damage caused by pests or diseases.
So what kind of conditions are we talking about?
The source lists a range: nutrient imbalances in the soil, either deficiencies or excesses, temperature extremes, both heat stress and frost freeze damage, toxicity from excessive salts in the soil or water, or from improperly applied pesticides or herbicides, air pollution damage, like from ozone or sulfur dioxide, problems with water, either drought stress from too little water, or root problems from water logging or poor drainage due to too much water.
Other causes mentioned are things like soil compaction, restricting root growth, sudden changes in soil grade around trees, or physical injury to the trunk, or roots from equipment or girdling wires.
Exactly. And it's important to realize that these abiotic problems not only cause direct damage themselves, but they also often significantly weaken the plant, making it more susceptible to attack by actual pests or pathogens later on. It's a double whammy sometimes.
So diagnosis here can be really tough. How do you figure it out?
It can be challenging, yeah. It often requires putting multiple clues together, looking at the pattern of damage across the field, or planting. Is it uniform, related to topography? Considering the site's history, checking records of recent pesticide and fertilizer applications, maybe doing soil tests or leaf tissue analysis to check nutrient levels. But here is the key distinguishing feature the source really emphasizes for telling abiotic disorders apart from biotic problems. Pest diseases.
What's the key?
Symptoms of abiotic disorders typically appear relatively suddenly across the affected area, and critically, they do not spread progressively through an individual plant over time, nor do they spread from plant to plant contagiously like a disease often does.
Ah, that's the giveaway. Pest or pathogen problems usually start small, maybe on one plant or one part of a plant, and then gradually get worse or move to neighboring plants. Abiotic disorders often just appear, maybe affecting multiple plants in an area similarly and simultaneously, and then they don't really progress further unless the underlying condition persists or worsens.
Precisely. That pattern is your strongest clue. And the source provides a helpful table correlating common abiotic symptoms with potential causes, highlighting how easily they can be mistaken for pest issues. For instance, sudden wilting, yellowing, and branch dieback might make you think of root rot disease or maybe vascular wilt, but it could simply be severe water deficiency.
Right. Or yellowing, dropping leaves, and dieback might look like a disease, but could be due to water logging and poor drainage suffocating the roots.
Or discolored, undersized, or distorted foliage might look like insect feeding damage or maybe a virus, but it could actually be a mineral deficiency, like lack of iron causing yellowing, or toxicity from herbicide drift, or even just sunburn on exposed leaves or fruit.
Or air pollution causing tiny yellow or brown flecks on leaves. Or unusually dark green foliage, maybe indicating excess nitrogen. Or suddenly succulent, weak growth that looks burned and attracts sucking insects, also potentially due to nitrogen excess.
And physical injuries like frost killing tender shoots and buds, hail shredding leaves or bruising fruit, lightning striking a tree leaving a characteristic streak, or sun scald causing dead, cracked bark on the sunny side of a trunk. All these can create symptoms like dieback or cankers that might initially be mistaken for disease or borer damage. Recognizing that these abiotic symptoms are often uniform on the exposed parts, appear suddenly after a specific event like a frost, and don't spread like an infection is key to accurate diagnosis.
Wow, okay. We've really, really dug deep into the source material today. It's a lot to take in.
It is. We covered that fundamental regulatory landscape for pesticide handling in California, really highlighting the non-negotiable requirement for certification and unpacking that surprisingly broad definition of who qualifies as a pesticide handler.
Yeah, that was eye-opening. And we explored why becoming a skilled pest detective, being able to accurately identify what you're dealing with and understand its biology, is the absolute starting point, not just for control to actually work, but to avoid those costly failures and, importantly, protect beneficial organisms.
And we mapped out that vast territory of potential issues you might face on a farm. From those four main pest groups, the weeds, the vertebrates, and the pathogens, all the way to that really challenging realm of abiotic disorders that can cleverly mimic pest damage, but need a completely different kind of solution.
You know, what really stands out from this deep dive for me is just the sheer volume of knowledge, of careful observation that's required to make informed, responsible decisions on a farm day to day. It's clearly not just about reaching for a product off the shelf.
Not at all. It's a continuous process, isn't it? Learning, observing, identifying precisely, understanding the biology of the pest and the host, and only then taking informed action.
And this isn't just abstract knowledge for passing an exam, although that's important for the certification we discussed. Yeah. It's practical knowledge for protecting yourself, the people you work with, the surrounding environment, and ultimately the health and productivity of the farm itself.
Exactly. The stakes are high.
So if this deep dive has maybe sparked more questions for you listening, or perhaps made you realize the depth of what's involved here, remember the sources point you towards some really invaluable resources. That UC IPM website seems like a gold mine.
It really is.
And there are experts available to help cooperative extension advisors, PCAs, diagnostic labs. You don't have to figure it all out alone. This knowledge we've discussed is really a starting point.
Building this kind of expertise, this diagnostic skill, it's definitely a journey, not really a destination you just arrive at. Constant learning.
So wrapping this up, what does this all really mean? Maybe the biggest takeaway, the shift in perspective, is recognizing that truly effective, sustainable pest management begins not with what's in the spray tank or what new product is available, but with what's in your head. Accurate information, sharp observation skills, a commitment to understanding the why behind the problem. And that, maybe more than anything else, is the true foundation for success in dealing with pests and diseases in agriculture.